Now, universality, still on the level of doctrine. What did Martin Lings add to the doctrine of universality? Very briefly, one of the misunderstandings that has arisen in relation to universality, the idea that all religions are equal paths to the truth, the transcendent unity of religions, unites all of the religions at their highest summits of sanctification, salvation. One misunderstanding, which Dr. Lings put right in one of his books, is that this view of the transcendent unity of religions somehow dilutes the particularity of your own faith. It weakens or minimizes or relativizes or marginalizes your attachment to your tradition by saying that all of them eventually lead to the same place, and therefore you lose the richness of the particularity of your tradition. In his writings, of course, Fridtjof Jorn has made it absolutely clear that the Christ who is before Abraham was leads to a perspective within Christian gnosis such that the historical treasures of the redemption are actually given a much wider and deeper compass by virtue of touching the roots of existence. Those treasures of the historical redemption of Christ are not diminished at all by virtue of this universal vision. It means that those particular treasures have a universal compass. Likewise, Martin Lings gave us this image in his book, What is Sufism?, which says the same thing but gives us, in a certain graphic way, this subtle transformation of an image of universality which helps us to see that the approach to the center does not mean a diminution of particularity. The well-known image to express the perennial philosophy as regards universality of revelation is that of a circle, circumference, points on the circumference which are the forms of the religion, and then a center to which the radius goes from the point to the center. So you have radii going all the way from the circumference to the center. Traveling along that radius is traveling along the esoteric path. So you're leaving the exoteric form and you're traveling towards the esoteric center. He then adds this: our image as a whole reveals clearly the truth that as each mystical path approaches its end, it is nearer to the other mysticisms than it was at the beginning. As you travel along this radius, you're obviously coming closer, not just to the center, but to the other mysticisms of the other traditions. So there's an approximation, you're coming closer. But there is a complementary and almost paradoxical truth which this image cannot reveal, but which it implies by the idea of concentration which it evokes. Very important. It implies it by the idea of concentration which it evokes. Increase of nearness does not mean decrease of distinctness. Increase of nearness does not mean decrease of distinctness. For the nearer the center, the greater the concentration, the stronger the dose. So as you're approaching the center of this circle, God, the essence itself, it's not just a question of you coming closer, it's a pulsating radiance of the particular concentrated dose of the essence of that religion that you're receiving at the same time as coming closer to it. So increase in nearness does not diminish the distinctness of what you're receiving. You receive more if you're a Muslim. You receive even more of the essence of Islam, not its forms, but that which makes Islam essential. And likewise for a Christian and a Jew, a Hindu, a Buddhist. It's only at the center that there is no longer any question of the essence of a form. It's now the essence of all of the essences. That point, there's transcendent unity. But anything short of that point, there's form and therefore particularity. But then this strong dose of the essential elements of your tradition come. And also as regards universality, Dr. Lings told us, and in a sense, it was because of this passage in his book and of a particular statement that he made about this perspective within Islam that encouraged me to write one of the books that was on sale outside, The Other in the Light of the One. This is a book about the Quranic doctrine of universality and the spiritual perspectives on that, particularly from the Sufi point of view. But what's so interesting, and what Dr. Ling stressed to us in his many discussions, was that the universality that is in the Quran is in accordance with the literal meaning of dozens of verses. Unlike any other scripture, you don't have to have deep interpretive strategies to extrapolate from the literal meaning of the verses a universal meaning. The very literal meaning of these verses are already universal. And he gives us a few of these in his book, What is Sufism? He says, all mysticisms are equally universal in that they all lead to the one truth. But one feature of the originality of Islam, and therefore of Sufism, is what might be called a secondary universality, which is to be explained above all by the fact that as the last revelation of this cycle of time, it is necessarily something of a summing up. The Islamic credo is expressed by the Quran as belief in God and his angels and his books and his messengers. That's Surah Al-Baqarah, verse 285. Surah number 2, verse 285. He also says this, the following passage is also significant in this context. Nothing comparable to it could be found in either Judaism or Christianity. For each we have appointed a law and a path. And if God had wished, he would have made you one people. But he hath made you as ye are, that he may put you to the test in that which he hath given you. So vie with each other, compete with each other in good works. Unto God ye will all be brought back, and he will tell you about those things wherein ye differed. Verses like this can be multiplied. Verses that clearly say God is at the root of the diversity of revelations. All people who believe in God and who follow their religion faithfully will be saved. It's very difficult to mount a logically watertight argument in favor of exclusivism from a Quranic point of view. And Dr. Ling used to say repeatedly towards the end of his life, Sunday after Sunday at our gatherings, he would say, the Quran has been shouted down for too long. The commentators have been shouting down the Quran, saying that it has to be interpreted, the literal meaning of these verses need to be interpreted in other ways than that which is clearly evident from their literal meaning. So that's why I dedicated my book on the Quran, not the one that Emma recommended and said that I was proud of. I'm afraid to say I'm proud of it is going a bit too far as well in a context like this. It's the one that I'm least ashamed of. Because it's so small, because it's the Quran speaking for itself, and it's not a weighty tome that has a lot of philosophy and metaphysics, which means it doesn't get read. This little book has a chance of being read and doing some good, and it's all about the Quranic message of peace and mercy. And it stems directly, as I say, from this facet of Dr. Ling's soul. Finally, essentiality on the plane of doctrine. To be very brief on this, I mean, the man had such an extraordinary versatility. Someone who had not only imbibed deeply at the essence, the source of Islam, but the essence and source of all the religions, not in a practical sense. He was very strict about maintaining a distinction between the religious practice and the religious spirit. You can enter into the spirit of other traditions through poetry, through the art, through the models of sanctity. You can enter into that spirit, as he did in that poem, Self-Portrait. But what you cannot do is mix any of the rites of the different traditions. He was very strict, as was for Chuf Shuan, against any kind of syncretism. But this, on the level of essentiality, of going to the essence of things, it was this that allowed him to go to the heart of Shakespeare, to the heart of Quranic calligraphy, to the heart of esoteric exegesis, to give us the most authoritative, peerless account of the Prophet in the English language of biography. It was this versatility that made C.S. Lewis say about him that I've never met anyone who has the apparatus that Ling's had when C.S. Lewis taught him in Oxford. He wrote in a letter to somebody that Ling's has everything. He has as much aesthetic sensibility as we do. He has the imagination. He's a poet. He has a sharp logical mind. He has the deepest intuition. There's nothing lacking in the structure of his subjectivity. Those are not exactly his words. What he said is that he's got the most complete intellectual apparatus. And I asked Dr. Lings just if this was true when I heard about it, and he confirmed very modestly that it was, that that is what C.S. Lewis said about him. However, he did say that in a kind of anticipation of what people might misunderstand about this essentialism going from the form to the essence, he said, you cannot go from the form to the essence except by virtue of the form, which means you have to abide by the form of your religion. You can't discard it. And in What is Sufism? I think it is, or in the... No, this is in the Book of Certainty. He says, the practices of the tariqa, the esoteric inner path, are in addition, but not in opposition, to the sharia, to what the sharia, the sacred law, prescribes for every believer. And he adds this very important point, esoterism, the inner path, includes exoterism. Failure to carry out strictly the commandments of the sharia would amount to a disqualification for entry into one of the Sufi brotherhoods. So there's no access to the essence except through the form. But the form is essentialized. That's the beauty of his perspective. I was speaking to Shams earlier this afternoon, a friend from Exeter, and he asked me about the prayers, the canonical prayer of Islam, the five daily prayers. And it brought home to me just how, for Dr. Lings, even the canonical form of the five daily prayers had become a form of dhikr for him. There was no sudden break between the esoteric practice invoking the divine name, like a mantra, Allah, Allah, Allah. For him, that was one mode of remembrance, and saying the five daily prayers was another mode of the same principle. And there was a seamless continuity for him, such that when you are so deeply interiorized, so close to the essence, your perception of even the forms of your religion become essentialized. All of those forms reveal the essence to you. So let's go quickly on to the second level, that of the soul, sentiment, the love, you might say, character. When we think of Dr. Lings's soul, so many qualities come to mind. This steadfast, unwavering discipline. This humility, as I've said, disarming humility, an utter childlike simplicity, total generosity. But if I had to choose one quality above all others, it would be the quality of lutf, roughly translatable as loving kindness, gentleness. It's one of its root meanings is subtlety. And it really means a kindness and a loving gentleness infused with subtle wisdom, and it derives an incredible power from its archetype, which is Al-Latif, the divine name, the subtle, the loving kind. But Al-Latif, Ya Latif, is an invocation to which you have recourse only in the direst of circumstances because of the immensity of the power that is unleashed by Latif. And it's almost like the power which is irresistible, springing forth from the intangible depths of infinite subtlety. And just saying those words now makes me think of the soul of Dr. Lings. There was such gentleness and such subtlety, and yet there was so much power in the very effacement that he had before God. He was not there in a certain sense, and precisely because he wasn't there, you felt the irresistible power of the divine, transmitted by him, through his faqr. And all of this contributes to what he would call a healthy soul, quite simply. He reminds us in one of his books that health, holiness, and wholeness were originally one word. To be perfectly well, he says, the soul must be complete. Holiness, wholeness, and health are in origin the same word and have merely been differentiated in form and in meaning through the fragmentation of language. The virtues of simplicity and sincerity are inseparable from this perfection, for each in its own way means undividedness of soul. Simplicity also means oneness, of course, etymologically. It's from the same root. Simplicity and sincerity, what we've been speaking about. And this sincerity, this integrity, this wholeness, and this holiness of Dr. Ling's is beautifully described in relation to sacred art. He's in a sense inviting all of us to have this reaction, the reaction of a healthy, whole, holy soul to sacred art. When he describes what should happen to us when we're confronted by sacred art, it's as if he's saying, if it's not happening to you, then look and see what remedy your soul needs to be restored to wholeness. When we contemplate a work of truly sacred art, the whole soul comes together as if in answer to an imperative summons. There is no question of any fragmentary reaction, for we cannot marvel enough. Here lies the essence of a sacred civilization, to be forever demanding, in all sorts of ways, that the soul should pull itself together and keep itself together. And in the response of souls to this demand lies one of the great superiorities of the past over the present. And then he gives a very small example. To take a very small but nonetheless significant example, when we listen to the dance music of the Middle Ages, even to that of the gayer dances, we do not have in any sense the impression that a fragment of the soul has splintered off rebelliously from all the rest. How accurate that is, a description of the reaction of most modern souls to modern music, where you get the sense that a fraction of the soul has split off rebelliously to escape from something, a reality that cannot be faced up to. Whereas this sacred music, on the contrary, one does not have in any sense the impression that a fragment of the soul has splintered off rebelliously from the rest of the soul. On the contrary, such music conjures up the presence of men and women who, in their pleasures, could not forget, and take note of this, could not forget and did not desire to forget the fleeting brevity of life and the certainty of death. Even in their pleasures, these people could not forget the fleeting brevity of life and the certainty of death. How opposite that is to what passes for art and music and culture today. It's the very opposite, that people are desperately, rebelliously trying to forget that life is short and death is certain. This is how wonderful, and how wonderful Dr. Ling's description is proven by a little anecdote that when I read this, it was about 2 years before I came to listen to some of the dance music he's describing. When I went to live next door to him in 1989, I said, could I borrow some of the music that you listen to? And he gave me, in those days it was still that traditional thing called a cassette. And so I had lots of these tapes, and I listened to them. And I listened to one in particular, and I thought, goodness, that really reminds me of this passage in Ancient Beliefs and Modern Superstitions. So on my next walk with him, I said, you know, Sidi, as he was then, I listened to La Basse Danse the other day, and it really reminded me of that passage you wrote in the book Ancient Beliefs and Modern Superstitions. And he just, without breaking step, he just said, as we were walking along, he said, Sidi, that's exactly the passage I had in mind when I was, that's exactly the piece of music I had in mind when I was writing that passage. So it was that music that produced this passage that made it so obvious when you read it, that yes, that is the music that he's talking about. And another one that I think I would strongly recommend if anyone's taking notes on this is My Lady Carey's Domp, which is my all-time favorite. So how do you arrive at this wholeness, this health, this holiness? The answer is, of course, very short, and the process is very long. The short answer is the greater holy war. It takes the whole of one's life to arrive at the station where you have attained victory in that holy war. What's very interesting, I'm sure all of you know, that when the Prophet returned from a battle, the Battle of Hunain, he said to his companions, we've returned from the lesser holy war to fight the greater holy war. And they said, what's greater than this battle we just had? And he said, the greater holy war is the war against your own failures, your own vices. He actually said jihad and nafs, the war pertaining to the soul. Not the war against the soul, it should be noted, the war pertaining to the soul, the war where you have to fight against your lower tendencies, your vices. This is the greater holy war, the greater spiritual struggle. And it's very interesting that in his books on Shakespeare, Dr. Lings reveals a lot about the meaning of the greater holy war, not just on his books on Sufism and Islam, but even in his books on Shakespeare. Consider what he says about Hamlet. The basic theme of Hamlet is summed up in the prince's own words. Virtue cannot so inoculate our old stock, but we shall relish of it. This means, Lings explains, it is no use plastering one or two superficial virtues over our old stock. That is the original sin which permeates our nature. Since in spite of all such virtues, we shall continue to reek of the old stock. What is next required here? In order to express fully what is in Hamlet's mind here, we must add, and now he's putting this in Hamlet's, as it were, in Hamlet's mouth, there is only one thing which can effectively wipe out the stench of our old stock, and that is the complete reversal of the fall, total liberation from the grip of the enemy of mankind, in other words, the slaying of the dragon. Or more simply, in the language of the play, revenge. So he shows that what revenge is in Hamlet is an echo or reflection of the totality of the determination required to take revenge upon that enemy within, preventing you from realizing your birthright, that perfection with which you were born, that God that's latent within you. So this new stock that's required, he refers to, Dr. Lings, as initiation into the mysteries, the lesser and the greater mysteries, is nothing other than the inoculating or grafting of a scion of man's primordial nature onto the old stock of his fallen nature, which will thus be effaced, stench and all, provided that the new primordial scion be duly tended and implacably protected against any suckers that the old stock may put forth in an attempt to re-establish itself. That tending and that protection are the rites and the disciplines of the lesser mysteries, the path of purification from original sin and the recovery of man's Edenic state. Now this is where, of course, he puts a tremendous amount of importance on the fact that we cannot fight this war, still less win it, without heavenly aid. And what that heavenly aid consists of are weapons forged by God himself, prayer, invocation, incantation, recitation. It's the performance of these rites, methodic concentrations, what the Dalai Lama refers to again and again and again in his speeches and in his books. Practice. We are practitioners. It's easy, he keeps saying, for practitioners. It's easy to have mercy upon your enemies if you're a practitioner. If it's not just theoretical and abstract. If you're sitting and concentrating on the divine reality, meditating upon it, making it part of your being, then everything falls into place. He says that for most ordinary believers, the war is a kind of desultory warfare, a state of truce with occasional skirmishes. But for those who have been initiated into the inner path, it's a permanent state of warfare, the jihad al-akbar. It doesn't cease. Now, I'm aware that I've probably gone over my time a little bit already, have I?
You have a little bit, please carry on.
I think what I will do is go very quickly to the final level, which is that of sincerity on the level of the heart equals sanctity. And in fact, I should really go back to the poem where I said at the beginning that there's a thinly veiled reference to the Virgin Mary. And in the self-portrait, where he says at the end, I'll repeat the words for you. No more, I say, would it had been, For I have seen what I have seen, and I have heard what I have heard. So if to tears ye see me stirred, presume not that they spring from woe. In thankful wonderment they flow. Praise be to him, the Lord, the King, who gives beyond all reckoning. Now, that last line, who gives beyond all reckoning, is, as I said earlier, a paraphrase of what the Blessed Virgin says to Zachary. Inna Allaha yarzuqu man yasha'u bighayri hisab. Truly God gives sustenance to whom he will beyond all reckoning. And we can be sure that Dr. Ling's intended us to make this connection. It's an allusion, an ishara to this verse. And of course it's well known that the tariqa to which Dr. Ling's belonged was called the Maryamiya tariqa, after a vision that Richard Shuan Sheikh Isa had of the Blessed Virgin. And Sheikh Isa, Fritjof Shuan, was not by any means the first Sufi to have this deep reverence for the Blessed Virgin. She holds a place of supreme importance in the Islamic revelation and in Sufism. In the Islamic revelation, the Quran, she's the only woman mentioned by name having a surah named after her, an entire surah. And there's a particular connection between the Blessed Virgin and the divine name Ar-Rahman, the lovingly compassionate. I've been insisting that Rahma, Ar-Rahman, does not only mean merciful or compassionate. It means loving mercy, loving compassion. And this is based upon a very important principle established by the Prophet when he said that a woman who was seen clutching a baby to her breast after having lost the baby at the battle of at the fall of Mecca, the conquest of Mecca. She'd lost her baby. She found the baby. She clutched the baby to her breast. And the Prophet said, do you see how much rahmah this woman has for her child? And they said, yes, Ya Rasulullah. And he said, God has more rahmah than for you than this woman has for her child. Now, when we speak in English about the relationship between a mother and her child, we think of love before we think of mercy or compassion. The mother's love for her child is organic. And out of that organic love, that total love, comes compassion and mercy. So if we want to talk about Islam, and we say Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, we have to understand that Rahma, Ar-Rahman and Ar-Rahim, the two divine names deriving from Rahma, are the lovingly compassionate, the lovingly merciful. And it's with this formula that every Muslim begins every legitimate act, this name of the names of mercy. And the Blessed Virgin embodies the Basmala. In one of his most beautiful poems, Fritjof Shuan says, Ya Basmala, Ya Hamdala, to her. O Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, O you who are the Basmala, you who embody the Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Now this relationship is of extreme importance, because the Blessed Virgin not only has this role in the Quran, she also, in Sufism, is regarded as the very personification of primordial sanctity. Ruzbehan Bakhli, a very important, famous Persian commentator of the Quran, one might say the most important metaphysician of aesthetics in the Islamic tradition. His Abhar al-Ashiqin is waiting to be translated into English, for example, a beautiful work on Islamic aesthetics. In his Quranic commentary on this chapter of Mary, he says, the substance of Mary is the substance of primordial holiness. Johar Maryam, Johar Fitratul Qudus. It's the very fitra, the primordial nature of holiness. So in this primordial nature of holiness, we're talking about the Blessed Virgin embodying Rahmah, radiating Rahmah. The divine name Ar-Rahman comes 17 times in this relatively short chapter, and it comes 57 times throughout the Quran. So more than a quarter, nearly a third, of all the instances of the divine name Ar-Rahman are given in the surah connected with Mary. It's to Ar-Rahman that she dedicates her fast. It's Ar-Rahman's revelations to which the prophets fall prostrate and so on. Ar-Rahman is coterminous with God. And this Rahma is what Martin Ling stressed and radiated at the end of his life as the manifest aspect of his sanctity. It's very easy for us to be compassionate and merciful. It's very difficult for us to restrain our egotism in the manifestation of compassion and mercy. And that's what happened with Martin Ling's. Because his compassion stemmed from a complete absence of egotism, neither was he in any way dependent upon our reaction to his compassion, his wisdom. In no way was it dependent upon our reaction, because that compassion stemmed from an effacement of his ego and a desire simply to radiate because God radiates. He used to say to us, man is made in the image of God. God radiates, man must radiate. You must give of yourself to everybody with wisdom and with compassion. And the reason why he was able to radiate this compassion is because he drank so deeply at its fountain. This fountain of the divine essence, there are various fountains which he talks about in his wonderful book, The Book of Certainty. And he talks about Kashani's commentary on the Surah Al-Insan, the Surah number 76, where there's a fountain of paradise from which the righteous drink, but it's flavored with the fountain. The slaves of God drink from the same fountain, but directly from it. And the more they drink from the more the fountain gushes forth in abundance. And Kashani, the great commentator who Martin Ling, as it were, brought to the Western world for the first time in his book that was published in 1952 or 53, The Book of Certainty, is based on Kashani's commentary, which is often ascribed wrongly to Ibn Arabi. And this is Dr. Ling's translation of this comment. Kafur, this fountain in paradise, is a fountain whereof drink a draught undiluted the slaves of God. These are his chosen ones, the people of the solitude of the essence. Their love abideth in the face of opposites, and their delights continue even amid graces and afflictions. They gush it forth in copious draughts. This is now from the Quran. Yufajirunaha tafjira. They gush it forth in copious draughts the more they're drinking from it, inasmuch as they, the slaves of God, are themselves the very springs of the fountain. For here there is no duality or otherness. There is no veil of individual selfhood or duality. So in the measure that the individuality has been effaced, in the measure that our egotism has been overcome, to the extent that this jihad has been faithfully fought and with the grace of God won, to that extent the ego will be absent. And then when the spirit drinks from the celestial fountains, those fountains gush forth even more copiously through the slaves, because the slaves are identified with these fountains of paradise. There is no difference. And I would just like to finish with two divine sayings which Dr. Ling's loved to quote and which sum up the kind of sanctity, the unity, the supreme identity that can be alluded to but never fully explained, still less understood with the mind. My earth cannot contain me. My heaven cannot contain me, but the heart of my believing servant does contain me. And the second hadith, this is God speaking through the prophet. My slave ceaseth not to draw near unto me through devotions of free will until I love him. Devotions of free will over and above the canonical required prayers, the greatest of which is the dhikrullah, the remembrance of God. My slave ceaseth not to draw near unto me through devotions of free will until I love him. And when I love him, I am the hearing wherewith he heareth, the sight wherewith he seeth, and the hand whereby he graspeth, and the foot whereupon he walketh. This expresses the supreme identity, the divine manifesting through the effaced individual, the effaced saint of God. And this dhikrullah, which is the greatest of the nawafil, the greatest of these voluntary offerings, was described by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam as the best act of devotion. And with the help of this saying of the Prophet, we can understand what it is that Martin Lings saw and heard. The Prophet said, "For everything there is a polish, and the polish of the hearts is the remembrance of God, the invocation of the name of God." لِقُلِّ شَيْءٍ سِقَالَ وَسِقَالَةُ الْقُلُوبِ ذِكْرُ اللَّهِ. And Imam Ali commented upon this in his saying, which interestingly comes on the verse of light, so famous in the Quran, and the verse following the verse of light, which contains at the end of it, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يَرْزُقُ مَنْ يَشَاءُ بِغَيْرِ حِسَابٍ, the same words that the Blessed Virgin said, the same words in this poem. Imam Ali comments on that verse by saying, "Truly God has made the dhikr, the remembrance, a polish," but using another word, jila'an, "a polish by means of which the hearts come to see after being blind and hear after being deaf." So this helps us to understand when Dr. Lings is saying, "I have seen what I have seen and I have heard what I have heard," he's seeing with the heart polished up by the remembrance of God. And he's hearing with a heart that has been rendered totally receptive to the revelation of God. Those are the notes on which I'd like to finish: the invocation of the name of God, the vision of God through all revelations, and most of all, the effacement of the individual in the beauty of the divine light which is being contemplated. Thank you for your attention.
It's difficult to know what to say, but thank you so much, Dr. Shah Kazmi, for a very, very beautiful lecture, which he's really brought the presence of Dr. Martin Lings with us tonight. I think all will agree. And he's agreed very kindly to we'll take three questions, because that's what Dr. Lings always was agreed to take himself. Three short questions, please.
Thank you very much. Is there a third question?
When you think of Martin Lings, if you bring a picture to your mind, could you tell us something about some of the pictures in your mind that you have of him?
Well, I'd feel like asking you that question and asking you to share that with us. That would be a lovely way to finish the lecture. And it's very difficult. I mean, just, it's the utter, seeing him in his mihrab. The mihrab is the niche in a mosque or in a prayer room, and it's actually the Blessed Virgin is, as it were, evoked in practically every mosque in the Muslim world, because when you go into a mosque and you see the direction of prayer where the imam normally stands to pray, above the prayer niche is normally inscribed that those words of the Blessed Virgin, preceding her words, that says, "Kullama dakhala alayha Zakariya al-mihrab." Those words are inscribed there. So they're an allusion to the Blessed Virgin. Every time Zakariya went in unto her at the mihrab, "Kullama dakhala alayha Zakariya al-mihrab, wajada indaha rizqa qala." And then he asks her, "Where did this come from?" "Anna laki hadha." "Where did you get this?" She said, "Innahu min indallah, inna Allah yarzuqu man yasha bighayri hisab." So I should have mentioned that point, that the Blessed Virgin is, as it were, present in practically all of the mosques implicitly, with this inscription over every mihrab. And Sheikh al-Bakr had this inscription as you entered into his zawiya. Now the actual niche in his zawiya, in his prayer room, is one in which he used to stand and pray for long hours. And if I have to answer Justin's request in the simplest way, is to say that my most wonderful image of him is the back of him facing the Qibla in complete silence, with the rest of us invoking the divine name behind him, but in complete silence. And this is another resonance with the Abu Bakr as-Siddiq, who was known for his dhikr khafi, his silent invocation, as opposed to jali, which is vocal invocation. And this was a specific kind of silent invocation that Dr. Lings had, and he would just stand for hours while the rest of us, after 30 minutes or 40 minutes, would start wilting. But he could stand with a different kind of energy, an energy we're beginning to understand, some of us fortunately through the barakah of invocation, and others through Qigong, that there's a certain kind of energy that is given to you that transcends your normal bodily energy. And he had that. Everything that people in Qigong are after, he had it. He had health, he had longevity, he had this extraordinary clarity. He was a living embodiment of the Taoist sage. And immortality, 96 years old. 96 years old he was when he died, and right to the very end he had clarity and hardly any health problems. So my lasting image is really him in his prayer room with his back to us, facing the direction of prayer, invoking silently and sometimes swaying gently. And that reminds me of a certain disciple who said that, "I have the impression when I'm behind Dr. Lings that we're like leaves just swaying in the trees."
Thank you.